So, okay. Keep thou not silent, O God. Hold not thy peace. And be not still, O God. So, who's Asaph? Pastor Paul touched on it last week. He was one of the chief musicians. He wrote 12 Psalms, 50, 73 to 83. So this is his last Psalm. And if you look at, I won't turn to it. In 1 Chronicles 25, 1 and 2, he was a worship leader, but David chose him and a few others to use their instruments to prophesy. So then the Bible makes it clear that a prophetic gift was bestowed upon him also. So we start looking at this, you know, until about this guy called Bill Salas came around the 2006 mark. That's when people started seeing this as a prophetic psalm. If you look at a lot of commentaries before that, people just make a comment, and a lot of people said done in 1948 or done. If the ones that you look at, for example, Spurgeon's one, that Israel didn't even exist, and it was just about, you know, yes, God will defeat his enemies, especially against people, against the church and things like that. So it's only around 2006. And I was listening to a few videos, and he was saying quite coincidentally, as 2006 was happening, and he was writing about it in Ireland while they were digging this bog. You heard that? Yeah, and they found all these old 22 manuscripts of the Old Testament. And one of the manuscripts that was left intact, because it was under the bog, you know, peat, just one of the things that were left manifest was Psalm 83. And he took it as a sign God was confirming to him that, you know, this is something. And he believes that in the past, like he claims 48, 67, God wasn't, that may have been a partial fulfillment, but God, he believes that God was silent. He didn't make it known. But now we're heading towards it. God is through him and through a lot of people like Chuck Mercer, Hal Lindsey. A lot of people started catching on to this and started re-promoting it. And so he believes in that way God is no longer silent and trying to get the word out. This is coming to pass. Rightly, wrongly, I'll leave it up to you. Go and decide. I mean, if you want to know about this, he's the definitive guy at this stage about, short of God, obviously, definitive guy at this stage about Psalm 83. So Asaph was a descendant of Levi. He's had a prophetic function, and Psalm 83 is also classified as what we talked about in precatory psalm, where basically people are going, God, why? And please take judgment on these people. Almost gives us, shouldn't, please don't go and ask for judgment against your enemies, but it sort of, it gives that human side where when you see injustice in the world, you can cry out to God, and God will answer. Okay, let's go to read verse 2 to 5. Peter, do you want to start one verse and we move down? Verses 2 to 5?
2 to 5. Yep. Verse 1, was it?
No, I've read verse 1, so go from 2 to 5.
Don't you hear the uproars of your enemies? Don't you see that your arrogant enemies are rising up?
Good. Verse 3.
Hello. Verse 3. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones.
They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.
Verse 5, for they have consulted together with one consent. They form confederacy against you.
Okay, so we can see, interestingly enough, the enemies are gathering. And they are forming a confederacy, as we talked about. And the interesting thing, as a lot of you pointed out, is that he's not saying they're forming against us, Israel. They're saying he's forming against you, God. It's your battle. We're your people. I mean, you think about it. That does take faith. To see himself, to see Israel as the apple of God's eye. We are on a better covenant. Do you see yourself? That when the enemies that come against you, you go, God, they're coming against me. They're coming against you. I mean, would you be that arrogant? Would you dare? If someone's giving you trouble at work or, you know, you go, God, he's not taking on me, it's you. He's fighting with you. I'm just your vehicle here. Most of us wouldn't dare do that, would we? Most of us would say, oh, we don't want to trouble God with problems. I mean, yes, these are attacking Israel. So, yes, it's a big problem. But It does take that level of faith. It does take of seeing myself as the apple of God's eye, and for the Israelites to see themselves as a chosen people. And you have a better covenant. Wow. So that's something that you can make personal for yourself. But the really thing, important thing is that they're coming together. They obviously have not only disdain for the nation Israel, but they have disdain for God. And we see the world moving to that. That being a Christian is, even in Christian countries, is now seen as you're, there's something wrong with you. Don't know how many of you follow the Wallabies. Have you heard of Israel Falau? Where the poor guy was asked a direct question, what will happen to gays when they die, or words to that effect? And his answer was, well, based on my belief, they go to hell, based on what God says. It wasn't like he went trumpeting it out and caused trouble. A journalist asked him, and he's being persecuted right now. So in a Christian, so-called Christian country, things will get bad. So understand that's the kind of thing, that they don't respect not only Christians, it's not about you, they don't truly respect Jesus. They don't respect God, and they don't care for Him. And that's a lesson we learned. There will be that coming to pass. And on top of that, in this case, they will come together as a confederacy against Israel. And for what reason? What does verse 4 say? They said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation. Prior to 1948, when was the last time Israel was a nation ruled by itself? Anyone venture a guess? Was it during Jesus' time?
No.
No, yeah, the Romans were ruled. Who was before the Romans? Come on, all you Daniel people. Who was before the Romans?
The Greeks.
Who was before the Greeks? The Assyrians. Is it? Or the Persians, the Medo-Persians. Who was before the Medo-Persians?
Are you serious?
Who was before the Medo-Persians? The Babylonians. And that's probably when Israel, or Judah, because Israel was taken by the Assyrians even before that. So for a long time, no one, before Israel 1948, everyone thought this was about either happened in the past or it's about church. And now that Israel's back as a nation, we can see it has relevance. And again, there's a slight, not a strongest argument, there are stronger arguments. 1948, they weren't as a nation, so they couldn't have cut off remembrance. Again, IDF didn't exist before 1948. It was almost a ramshackle kind of thing. So, but you can argue 67, you can argue 73. But it doesn't seem to fully come to pass. So one of the reasons here of this Psalm 83 confederacy, their purpose, is to destroy Israel. And you think about it, we just mentioned, what is the mandate of pretty much every single nation around it? In their constitution, in their religious belief, in what they say in public. Even Abbas, who's meant to be the moderate Palestinian, makes statements to basically wipe out. So land sharing is never going to work. Peace treaty is never going to work. Yeah. When I was in Israel, I was chatting to one of my she was a Jewess taking us around. And she wanted to find a Palestinian woman to come together and write a thesis for the university on to try and mend the hatred and to try and find peace, because she felt so many young men on both sides were dying. And I tried to explain to her, the hatred is spiritual. It goes beyond reason. It's not like my great-grandfather stole your donkey, okay, here's a donkey and you're fine. It doesn't work that way. It is so spiritual, it's so ingrained that it will never finish until God finishes it once and for all. So the key thing I want to remember here is that they are coming to wipe Israel out. There's no more remembrance. Okay, let's read verses 6 to 8.
Byblos, Ammon, and Amalek, Philistia, and with the people of Tyre.
Okay. At that point, I'm not sure whether most of you are interested. Remember I told you about the Irish manuscripts? This picture of the Irish manuscripts. And this picture of sort of it preserved Psalm 83. But when you read things like Gebal, Tyre, Assyria, we may have sort of idea. Ammon, besides Peter, most of us go, where's that? Moab, Edom, Amalek, Philistia, you may have some idea. Hagarites, Ishmaelites, sorry?
Palestine.
Yes, Palestine, yeah.
Byblos is Babylon.
Byblos is Babylon. Byblos isn't mentioned here. So let's have a look. So the tabernacles of Edom is the first one. Ishmaelites of Moab, the Hagarines, Gebal, Ammon, Amalek, the Philistines, and the inhabitants of Tyre. Asur is also joined with them, and they have helped the children of the Lot, Selah. Now, essentially, I've got it in a note so you can change, look to that shortly, but essentially, if you look at this picture here, that sort of lists out where they are. And they are what, you know, if you look into this, there's always this talk of inner ring countries and outer ring countries. And these are the inner ring countries because they are just next to Israel. So Gebal and Tyre is Lebanon. They're just cities in there. In the past, before, a few days ago, I always thought to myself, well, Hezbollah, because they said Tyre is down south, Hezbollah makes sense. But Gebal was north. And at that stage, Gebal was controlled not really by Hezbollah. But now with the recent elections, Hezbollah hasn't actually increased the number of parliamentary seats, but all its allies have increased, and so they effectively now control Lebanon. Which then brings this one step closer. So Gebal is in play. Assyria, I mean, I don't need to tell you where. Assyria is where basically Syria and Iraq, where the ISIS used to have a stronghold, but basically now Iran is in there, Russia's in there. Ammon, Moab, Edom. Ammon and Moab is like Jordan. Philistia is your Gaza Strip. Hagarines. Hagar is the mother of Israelites, I mean Egyptians, and Ishmaelites, part of Saudi Arabia. So this whole area here is what is suggested as the confederacy of the nations that is coming against Israel. So basically all its neighbors. And an interesting thing is the one that's listed first. If you go back to the time of Genesis, the person that's listed first usually is like the major player, the leader. It's the tents of Edom. And Edom is this section here, which is part of Jordan here. But every other thing is mentioned like a nation. This one is a tent. What does tent give you an impression of? Sorry?
Gaza,
but why? What does tent? If I say to you, I live in a tent versus I live in a house.
Refugees.
Temporary.
Nomadic
would be another one of them. But who in that area of these surrounding nations has temporary accommodation, not a place to call home?
Palestinians.
Sorry? No. I mean, Saudi Arabia is rich. It's got its own place.
Palestine.
It's the Palestinians, isn't it? And a lot of the Palestinians trace their roots to Edom, the Esau region. And a lot of Jordan is made of Palestinians. So the number one issue, the number one lead nation in this confederacy is tents of Edom. If you go to any Muslim, Arab person, nation, and ask them, what's the problem with Israel? What's their number one current problem in Israel? What is it? The way they treat their poor Palestinian refugees. The way they've stolen the land and abused the Palestinian refugees. What is the one thing that will probably spark war? Is that if Israel just completely takes back the West Bank or takes back Gaza, that would set things up for an attack, wouldn't it? So suddenly it's amazing when you realize, God, what did God declare about himself? How do you know that I am God? What does he say in the Bible? I will declare. Know that I am God because I declare the end from the beginning. And if Asaph is around 1000 BC, around King David's time, I mean, how many thousand years ago? How can you look in the future and predict all these players? That these weren't players that were around the way it's drawn up. You wouldn't know these were players. I mean, Edom really was actually half-brother, from descent from Esau, half-brother. And they were for a while told not to touch the descendants of Esau. God told them to. So to be able to call out, to see that, you know God has a hand in this. Okay, so let's turn to... I'm sort of going through quickly because I want to cover a few things and then there'll be interesting discussions ahead. Now, in my next point is that, what is this about? Isn't this the same as Ezekiel 38:39? Now, someone like Walid Shobat tends to go, It's all just one big war. It's about the Muslims. It's all one big war. And to some extent, I actually can see where he's coming from. And it's actually quite an interesting look at it, and it's a separate discussion. But one of the things that every sort of person who has some interest in prophecy talks about, one war that is described in two chapters in the Old Testament. Do you know which two chapters I'm talking about? Ezekiel 38, 39, isn't it? We may not have read Ezekiel 38, 39, but we all know that it's got something to do with the end time war. And so the question being is that Ezekiel 38, 39 is this massive war. Some place people place it at Armageddon war. Some people place it at the before Armageddon, especially if you're a pre-tribulationist. And some people say, this is basically another, like God shows different prophets the same war. And this is possibly another repetition of that. And so, because this is a Bible study, and this is a common view, because before 2006, before Bill Sellers, a lot of people read Psalm 83, knew it was prophetic, and thought it was just pointing towards Armageddon war, kind of thing. And Walid Chobot has similar kinds of view. So one of the things that if, I guess, we don't have that much time, but one of the things, let's turn to Ezekiel 38 and we'll quickly go through it. I was actually wanting to read the whole 25 verses, but it may be slightly difficult. Okay, I'll read it out, okay? It said, verse 1, and the word of Lord came to me saying, son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land, Ezekiel 38. The land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, thus said the Lord, I am against thee, Gog, and O Gog, chief of the Meshach and Tubal. And he says, blah, blah, blah. And then in verse 5, he goes, Persia, Ethiopia, Libya with them. So it talks about Gog, talks about Magog, talks about Meshach and Tubal, and talks about Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. Fortunately, those we can have some idea of who they are. And in verse 6, Gomer and all his bands, and the house of Togarma and the north quarters and all his band. So here we seem to have a different set of players, and they seem to be different in name to the Psalm 83 players. And here is sort of a picture of, and I won't go through too much details, we're running out of time, of who they are. So some people believe Magog is Russia, Gog, Magog, Russia. But some people believe it's Turkey. I mean, but also some believe like Meshach and Rosh is like the Scythian nations, all the stans, Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, all the lower parts. Gomer, Tomara, Tubal is Turkey. Then you've got Put Kush, which in this translation, they've translated fortunately for us, Egypt, Libya, and Persia is obviously key. Now, with this where they are located, do they look like the same group of people that Psalm 83 is referring to? No. So there's that reason, one of the reasons why people don't think it is the Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38 is one, the main antagonists or the players in this thing are different. They like to call the 83 the inner circle nations and Ezekiel 38 the outer circle nations. But I'll now tell you why they believe they're linked in one way. Because in verse 8, verse 11, and verse 14, and I'll read them out to you. And he says, after many days thou shalt be visited, in the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, that is gathered out by many people against the mountains of Israel, which have always, which been always, but is brought forth other nations, and they shall dwell safely among them. So this is a thing. According to this, Ezekiel 38, verse 8, Israel dwells safely among these, in that location. Verse 11, and thou shalt say, I will go up. He's talking about Gog and Magog and all these nations. And they say to themselves, I will go up to the land of the unwalled villages. That's another key criteria. That Israel lives safely in the land and there are no walls. Okay? Well, and I will go to them and that they are at rest and dwell safely. Again, the word dwell safely. When words like that is mentioned of multiple times in a short context, it has meaning. So again, God mentions that Israel dwells safely, all of them dwelling without walls and have neither bars nor gates. So suddenly we're confronted with a picture of an Israel that has no bars and gates, they're dwelling safely in the land. And verse 14, there, son of man, prophesy and say unto Gog, thus said the Lord God, in that day when my people of Israel dwell safely, shall thou not know it? So within that short 14 verses, when he's prophesying against this Ezekiel 38-39 war, God is saying that this war will happen when Israel dwells safely. No walls, no guards, no fences, no nothing. This is the walls that Israel has, so many walls and fences and everything within their nation. Go to Israel, everyone's carrying a gun, military service, everything like that. Do you truly believe that Israel dwells safely? Pretty hard to believe, and everyone around you is trying to, has in their constitution and charter, they're trying to wipe you out from this planet, isn't it? So suddenly, but what is possible? What is possible? And this is where people try and link it together. If Psalm 83 happens, where the inner nations, inner circle nations, attack for the one last time, the last major Arab-Israeli war. We've had a few in the past, and they attack, and Israel, God uses, through the IDF and through his intervention, especially through IDF, decimate the Arab-Israeli war. From 48 to 67 to 73, every time there's an attack, what happens with the borders of Israel? They get bigger, don't they? They take the Golan Heights, Sinai Peninsula, they take all, as much as they can take without the United Nations coming say, give it back. But every time. So imagine if all these nations attack and they manage to decimate them, wipe them out, and claim that land. Do you think with the riches that is part of that land, the oil and everything like that, and to be able to secure much larger borders where people just can't just fire stuff too far without them having defenses set in place, possibly, Israel can dwell safely. Possibly, Israel would be richer than what it is today. Because that's an important point, because in Ezekiel 38, the next thing that it says in verse 12 is this. God is saying to Gog and Magog, the reason why they want to come and destroy Israel, come to attack Israel, not destroy, attack Israel, is in verse 12, in Ezekiel 38:12. To take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thy hand upon desolate places that are now inhabited and upon the people that have gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods and dwell in the midst of land. So essentially what this Ezekiel 38:39 war is a war of plunder. Israel has become phenomenally rich for whatever reason, and Gog, Magog, Tubal, Meshel, all this surround, now the outer nations have gone, wow, they've got a lot. We want some of that. We want all of it. But what was the reason we learned in Psalm 83 that those inner circle nations wanted to attack Israel in verse 4? What was the reason? Let's turn to verse 4. Correct? One is Ezekiel 38:39 seems to be, I'm greedy, I want what you have, I'm coming to try and take it. Well, Psalm 83 seems more of, I hate you. I have a spiritual hate of you that I want to destroy you and ground you to the end of the earth until your name is not remembered. Very different reason, isn't it? If you look at verse 12 in Psalm 83, it gives another reason. Who says, let us take ourselves the houses of God in possession, or the land of God in possession, the pastures of God in possession. Which nations now want the land Israel have? Palestine, tents of Edom. All the surrounding nations want to help them get that land. They want to wipe it out. Do you think Russia truly cares about the land? No, Russia is in Syria because of the oil and the gas pipeline and everything like that. Libya doesn't really give two hoots about. Neither does Ethiopia. So already it's quite clear cut if you take the text of the Bible as what the text of the Bible is. Ezekiel 38:39 and Psalm 83 wars are different. But the link possibly is this, that Psalm 83 has to happen to enable the preconditions of Ezekiel 38:39 to happen. So Bill Sellers likes to talk about now prophecies and next prophecies. Now prophecies means it can happen now, anytime now. And next prophecies mean it'll happen sometime in the near future. but not now. Yeah, and to some extent, that's where possibly, the idea that Psalm 83 is coming really close. Why? Because the players in the Ezekiel 38, 39, if you believe who they are, Russia, Persia, and Turkey, where are they now? They're the main players in Syria right now, aren't they? So they're gearing up, setting things in place. It's almost like they may even sort of cajole and help the surrounding nations attack to try and weaken Israel. And there might become a pass where if there is that attack and Israel wins, there will be a time where Israel dwells in great safety. And then all those nations that were Arab nations will suddenly fall in line and go, oh my goodness, we've always known that God's on Israel's side. Maybe he is the true God. I mean, in 2006, when there was that Hezbollah 34-day war, where there wasn't that clear, decisive victory by Israel, I remember talking to an Egyptian friend of mine. He's Coptic Egyptian, more secular than anything like that. And he, in a sense, you could see something in him where he went, oh, Israel can be defeated. You know, it's almost from that 48, 67, 73, all the surrounding nations have built in them this inferiority that they've lost so many times. There's nothing they can do because Israel's going to win. They blame technology, they blame US, they blame anything else. But maybe this time, when they lose and lose so completely, their eyes will be lifted and they say, it must be God. It must be God. Now, don't get carried away. Let's read from verses 9 to 11. So whose turn is it to read from verses 9 to 11?
Do to them as you did to Midian, as you did to Sisera and Jabin at the river of Kishon, who perished at Endor and became like refuse on the ground. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeeb, or their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take possession of the pasture lands of God.
Let's stop there. Who are these characters? Every time when you read names like that, you go, who are these fellas? Who am I going to make sense head or tail of these guys? Thank goodness for commentaries. Thank goodness for... Okay. Yeah, that's right. So essentially these were... Asaph was referring back to the period of judges. Period of two judges in particular. Deborah and Gideon. And these were the wars that they fought. Gideon against the Midianites. Deborah against with Barak against the Canaanites. And the defeat was so resounding that those two nations never, ever troubled Israel again. So that, Peter, lends to another reason why possibly this is not fully complete. Because even in 48, 67, 73, all those nations still exist. And they still trouble Israel. But the really nice thing about it, let's turn to, Judges 7, verse 19 to 25. Is that, who knows this, who can sort of vaguely remember the story of Gideon? What happened with Gideon? Vaguely. Sorry? But when it comes to the war, do you know what happened? Yeah. Something about bending down and drinking. Judges 7, verse 19 to 25. Essentially, they were facing a massive army of Midianites. Maybe 120,000, I don't know how many. He got quite a big number. 3,000 or... 300. I thought it was 120. I thought it was 3 to 1. But anyway, I could be wrong. Don't forget numbers per se. But God wanted to go... The battle belongs to me.
That's
right. So when they got to this drinking water, we actually went to in Israel. Who went to that place, to the so-called well? So the ones that are all really tough warriors, you know, when you're a warrior looking for war, you go on a drink, you're drinking with one eye open, and you drink like that. The ones who are farmers and peasants who don't know what, and they're tired, they just go just go straight face in and, oh Lord, I'm tired, I don't care, I want a drink. And guess who God picked? There were 300 of them who weren't warriors and fighters and ready to fight. They're just like, oh, I'm too tired. They said the one that Gideon, God told Gideon, yeah, take these men, 300 of them. Gideon must have gone, you sure, God? These are like the, not the right stuff, the wrong stuff people. Yeah, not who you pick as astronauts or fighter pilots. These are the guys who...
I thought it was the other way around.
What do you mean?
Or pick the unalert ones.
If you pick the best of the best, yeah, and they win the war,
oh,
versus you pick the worst of the worst and they win the war, which you think is God's hand? The worst of the worst, isn't it? So Gideon and 100 men that were with him came to the outside of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, and they put newly set the watch and blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers and were in their hands. And the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers and held the lamps in their hand and the trumpets in their hand and blew. And they cried, "The sword of the Lord of Gideon, and Gideon." And they stood every man in his place around the camp, and all the host ran. This is around the Midianite armies, and cried and fled. And 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword, that means the Midianites, against his fellows. So they started panicking, confused, attack each other, even throughout all the hosts, and the host fled to Beshitta and Zarata and to the border of Abel-Mehola, Taba, mispronunciation. And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali, out of Asher, and out of Manasseh, and pursued after the Midianites. And this was a massive army. And God brought confusion in that land among the people with a tiny force. And essentially, time and time again in 48, 67, 73, they were outnumbered. They didn't even have an air force in 48, or two or three little biplanes that were flying. And they managed to defeat overwhelming odds. And there were stories like, I think it was the 67 or 73, Yom Kippur Wars, I think it was, where they were so busy fighting on the north end against Syria and Lebanon, south against Egypt, Jordan rolled their whole tank division, crossed the Jordan River, stopped outside Jerusalem, and went, there's no one defending Jerusalem. And the tank commander, instead of going in and capturing it, thought it must be a trap.
Yeah.
And sent one scout who rolled all the way to Jerusalem without a shot being fired at it and raided back. There's no one here. It must be a trap. Don't come in. So they pulled back, waited until Israel could come back and defend Jerusalem. I mean, you talk about the Golan Heights. Don't look at the Golan Heights tank battles. It was just amazing. It's just overwhelming odds. Amazing. And you just see God's hand in it. It is... And the thing is, God will use the IDF. Ezekiel 37:10 says the dry bones will become a great exceeding army. And they will rise up and defeat. And if you look at Ezekiel 38:39, instead of using the IDF as much, you see God's hand in earthquakes and hurricanes and things like that. So that's why there's another suggestion that it's a different battle where God is more at hand in this. So where 38, 39, that's another debate which we don't have time for. So remember the major differences, but the tie-in, the major differences are why they want to do battle, the enemies, one is the inner ring nations and one's the outer ring nations, and why they want to take, one for plunder, one to obliterate Israel. And one uses the IDF, one where God is in this, don't get me wrong, God is always in this. But one, God is even more in the forefront. Okay, you can read the notes are there on the reference for Barak and Deborah's defeat, just the names of the princes involved. But essentially the defeat was so total that the Canaanites and Midianites never troubled Israel again. But we know, even though 48, 67, 73, the current group of the current lot around them still trouble Israel and still want to wipe them out. Okay, so let's read Psalm 83 and 13 to 18, because that's a good bit. That's ends on a high note. Whose turn is it to read 13 to 18? Let's take turns. Who's next in reading? Peter, is that you?
Yeah.
Yep. So 13.
Oh my God, verse 13. Oh my God, make them like the whirling dust, like the chaff before the wind, as the fire burns the dust, and as the flame sets the mountains on fire. So pursue them with your tempest, and frighten them with your storm.
Yeah, go ahead.
16. Fill their faces with shame, that they may seek your name, O Lord. Let them be confounded and dismayed forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish, that they may know that you, whose name alone is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth.
Isn't this so like God? Where even though he uses the IDF, uses the Israeli army, uses Gideon, uses Barak, he's behind it. He wins the battle. I think Asaph is trying to let us, the readers, know and let cry out and let declare to the world that whatever battle that you may think you win, it is actually the Lord. When Jesus told Peter to chuck up the net to catch the fish when he saw him again, when he was so Peter was depressed, he denied Jesus 3 times. What did he do? He went fishing. And so like most men, they like the solitude and they go fishing. And he brought his mates and they caught nothing. And then when he saw Jesus, he said, throw out the net. Throw out your nets on that side. But he didn't catch anything. He protested. But he didn't throw out his nets. He threw out a net. But what did Jesus say when he brought in this overwhelming number of fish? He said, bring the fish that you've caught. Isn't it so like God? That he provides the victory to you. He provides everything to you. And he says, well done, Eddie. You've done so well. Well, you've just been a vehicle. You've just allowed yourself to be a vehicle to bring God's plan to pass. But he gives you the glory. I mean, that's a love kind of relationship where, you know, you help your child do something, they achieve something. If you're the one holding him on the bike, making sure he doesn't fall and all, but you go, well done, son, you rode your bike. And that's a loving nature. Even within a context of war, you see that God is behind it all, but God gives you the pleasure to be part of his plan and his victory. That's an amazing God we have, isn't it? Really, really powerful. But the thing is that in verse 16, that those nations around them will seek his name. Those nations will declare. And to some extent, it when thinking this through, having that Berean thing, when I first proposed this, it seems so incongruous. And for a long time, I mean, I still am, I'm not 100% sure where this, you know, only God knows, and he'll play it out as he is, but I'll strongly be actually backing Walid Chobert. I think to some extent, there's a lot of reasons why I think Islam will be a major player in still. But to have that surrounding Arab-Israeli nations be defeated, leading to the Israel's Ezekiel 38-39 war, seems to fit literal interpretation of the Bible, which is something I quite favor. I want to look at, and so it is very interesting. And it also fits other things. Because in Obadiah, let's turn to Obadiah. I don't have to, but I'll turn to Obadiah myself. And in Obadiah 1:18-20, and it talks about Edom. And don't forget, who was the major player, the number one name mentioned in the Psalm 83? The tents of Edom, isn't it? And Obadiah basically prophesies against a judgment against Edom. So in verse 18-20, it says, and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. So like Jacob, Joseph, Israel, in other words, they'll be like burning down. And the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them and devour them. And there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord hath spoken it. So essentially he's saying when this conflict, if it's that final Arab-Israeli conflict, Esau, Edom, will be wiped out. But then, if you turn to Isaiah 19, which a lot of you, I'm sure, are very, very familiar with, it is a very, very strange chapter. Because if you turn to Isaiah 19, 18-25, you know, we always think of Assyria and Egypt as hated by God, Israel's enemy. We see Edom, who was half brother of Israel, basically through Jacob, who was told not to be touched. Now God has said, you'll be wiped out completely. Nothing will remain of you. But in Isaiah 19, it says, in that day, verse 18, shall five cities of the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan and swear to the Lord of hosts. One shall be called the city of destruction. In that day, verse 19, there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar in the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be a sign for a witness unto the Lord of the hosts of the land of Egypt. For they shall cry unto the Lord because of their oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And the Lord shall be known to Egypt, and Egyptians shall know the Lord in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. Yea, they shall make a vow unto the Lord, and perform it. And the Lord shall smite Egypt, and shall smite and heal it, and they shall return even to the Lord, and he shall be entreated of them, and shall heal them. In that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Syrians shall come to Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Syrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. I always thought this was going to be the millennium period. But possibly, because of this war, because it involves Assyria, Egypt, that because they're so decimated, and Psalm 83 says, they will know my name. Verse 16, they shall seek your name, and they shall know, in verse 18, that they may know you, whose name alone is Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. There is a possibility. Let scripture interpret scripture, that Isaiah 19 highway, which a lot of people use as a house of prayer, of a highway of prayer, but it could also mean a physical domination, that whole land under God's people serving God, loving God, out of this war, because the whole purpose.
That highway is actually under plan, if not construction already.
Mm.
So there used to be an ancient highway that actually takes it all the way to Syria and going right through two-way. Actually crosses around where Jesus grew up. Bethlehem, is it? Jesus grew up. Yeah, Nazareth. Bethlehem. No,
he was born in Bethlehem, but Nazareth. Right. Yeah.
So that plan to resurrect it is already there.
Yeah.
I mean,
the reason why Jerusalem or Israel was such a hotbed of activity was that it was unfortunately the center highway between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Every time they wanted to fight with each other, they had to go through there. So Jerusalem always got whacked for no apparent reason except geography. But what I'm trying to say is that with this war, because it's pretty hard to see Isaiah 19 come to pass. Unless you want to see it in the millennium period, where then Jesus rules everything. But then the world will be Jesus.
That's right.
But if this is to come to pass before Jesus comes back, one of the possibilities is in Psalm 83. Where because all the inner nations, which includes Assyria, which includes Egypt, attack, they get decimated, they all bow down and realize and know that Abba Father is God. He is Yahweh. He is Elohim. He is God. And Allah is not. And possibly that highway will exist. Yeah.
Actually, when you look at the early part of Isaiah 19, context of that happening is because the evil king rises and they begin to cry out for deliverance.
Mm.
So God begins to move, and that results. So it sounds like that highway is created out of very extreme crisis they're going through, which probably includes the war. Mm-hmm. Five cities are picked to become part of actually Israel territory and learning the language of Hebrew. So very, very interesting.
Because a lot of leaders, a lot of prime ministers, a lot of generals go to war, and who does the dying? The people. They sit back and in their war room, and so the people are being oppressed. And then when they realize, the average person realizes that they're losing, and they, even though they have superior numbers, superior whatever, they're still losing, and it's because of God. Something changes in them. So, okay, any thoughts, any ideas? Because one of the other things that I didn't realize how much time you have, so I actually painted a very big brush strokes over everything. Because any of these lines, you can run down a rabbit hole and spend hours. Because one of the other things that Bill Sellers suggests, which I sort of briefly mentioned, is he ties this to Zechariah 12, which Pastor Paul will be preaching on on Sunday, per se.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying what he's proposing is gospel.
Yeah.
Be a Berean, look at what he's saying, analyze it for yourself. Even though I think it's very plausible what he's saying, and I like a lot of things what he's saying, I'm not fully 100% convinced. I'm convinced in the details, some of the details. But one of the things that does, like Walid Shobat, like Mike brought up, one of the things is for Islamic prophecy, there will be this Mahdi character that will come. And he will be set himself as God. He will bring secret texts and knowledge that will convince Jews and Christians that Allah is the true God. And many will be deceived. Sounds familiar? He'll declare himself, things like that. Sounds like a very anti-Christ kind of character. So, yeah, so but if Islam is wiped out completely, then how does that play about? I don't know. Or maybe the Arab nations get wiped out completely, but Islam still grows in some way or other. Maybe through the Catholic Church. I don't know, that's not good. That's not open another can of worms. So any thoughts? Because this, I actually want to hear from y'all. I mean, a lot of y'all are very interested in Israel, very interested in current events. You know, any thoughts? What are your thoughts after being... Yep, sorry.
Very interested in that Ezekiel 37
bones.
You read about the plundering around the areas, and then there will be peace, and then Israel will have a bigger territory.
Yep.
How does it tie in with the Abraham
offspring?
Remember I showed you that I sort of...
Yeah,
all the way here.
If you look at what was promised to Israel, I remember a year or so ago, looked at Psalm 83, and I looked at all the nations of the inner circle.
Yeah.
If they truly take everything, they will get very close to what God promised them.
Egypt, all those people, I think as the peak of Israel, even David hasn't conquered those areas.
No, not at all.
Yes, actually, when you look at Genesis 15, last verse, it talks about exact original promised land to Abraham.
Yeah.
That's actually, it looks like bit like this.
Yeah.
And it actually takes out all the inner ring countries.
Yeah.
In fact, you refer to Obadiah as well. When you look at the next few verses of Obadiah, it actually pinpoints currently all the inner ring circle of the troubled areas, like Golan Heights, and then right now Samaria is actually the West Bank.
Yeah.
Talk about the Gaza Strip and then all that. Is actually going to be taken out by Israel. It's pretty clear Israel will take it and possess it. So that pinpoints all the travel spots exactly as is.
So that means Abraham promised all the way back to how many thousand years ago?
Abraham promised will eventually be given, sooner or later. I guess the debate is whether Psalm 83 will eventuate all of their land or whether it will take out most of the kingdom era. I guess that's a little bit debatable, but
I mean,
we will have to see. Well, if it is connected with all, like, Jeremiah 49, Syria, and the bigger circle, even the bit of a Dedan, all that area, all the prophecies, Jeremiah 49, I mean, different parts of Isaiah, all that, much of it actually ties in with Psalm 83 wall in one lot. That's what it's going to look like. But we don't know how it will unfold, whether it will be a little bit here, a little bit there, and all that, when it eventually jigsaw puzzles all fit in. So I guess for me, very convincing, by the way, Edwin, you gave an excellent summary.
It's
so easy for us to understand.
Yep.
But how it's going to all come to pass, I'll have to wait and see whether it comes in piecemeal or in one go. But what we see is it's very, very close. In fact, I feel Isaiah 17 of Damascus prophecy is actually so close.
Mm.
And then right now, politically, that's also connected with Jeremiah 49 about the Elam, the Bashar reactor, the enrichment program. It's very, very closely right now tied together. So I think at least those two will go together. And some of the inner rings. But we will have to wait and see.
Definitely when Jesus comes again, it'll all be it'll be taken back. But if you take Psalm 83, a good 7/8 will be taken back. Yeah. So yeah. Any other questions? Any thoughts?
Well, the 1948 war, how did they win?
How did they win?
Yes.
God.
I was looking at a documentary some years ago.
Yeah.
They say the Britain sent a general. This general is known as Allenby.
Yeah.
And then they thought it was God. The Arabs thought it's Allah. And they was feared.
I wouldn't be surprised. At the end of the day, it's quite amazing.
Also, Psalm 83, one verse there is talking about that the whole world may know that Yahweh. It's actually the Lord there.
Yeah.
It's Yahweh, the name of the Lord. So it's kind of this war is a war between Yahweh and Allah in the inner ring. Obviously, there are Turkey and other nations that are not going to be taken out at this time. That's going to be very clear kind of war that will cause revival among those people.
This war is coming.
If this Psalm 83 points to this war, yes, it should be getting quite close.
If it's just there, it's like World War.
No, not World War.
Well, I don't think it'll be World War at this stage. It'll be just there, but then every other nation can be affected. And how the remaining nations of the world want to actually be with Israel or against Israel will determine a lot of things. Yeah.
Determine their own destiny.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Peter, your sense.
Sorry. Whenever if you want to build the temple, then the mosque has to go, right?
Yes. That is a very good point.
Is that why they're so against?
Then this inner circle war will probably happen, and then the Muslims will probably accept Jesus as Messiah, and then they will allow the temple to be, I don't know.
That is one of the possibilities, because...
Yeah. And then after that, Russia and all people will greedy, and then they'll come and attack.
Yeah. But don't forget, those people who attack lose also in Ezekiel 38, 39.
Yeah.
So that's another question which we don't have time to get into, where that happens and when that happens and what the implications are. And where you put it sort of shows your eschatology, your end time beliefs. So that's another big kettle fish. But what I'm trying to say with 83, it could have happened. It could have happened in part. But there's strong sense that it's going to happen soon. Why soon? Because if you look at the main players of Ezekiel 38, 39, they are already starting to encroach down. And they need an excuse. And then the question then begs asking, if America stays on Israel's side, where's America in this? That's another good question. Anyway, thank you everyone.
Thank you. Everyone.
Let's close with a word of prayer. Pastor, do you want to close with a prayer? Yep.
Heavenly Father, we thank you, Lord.